From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's show, I talk with comic Graham Chapman. As a member of the comedy group Monty Python, Chapman played everything from King Arthur to an old woman. Also, photographer Bruce Davidson talks about his latest book, pictures of the people who commute on or live in the New York subways. Music critic Francis Davis says a new recording of Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue means we can finally hear the piece the way Gershwin intended it. And TV critic David Bianculli advises us on how to avoid the tube's worst. That's all coming up on today's edition of Fresh Air. My guest on Fresh Air is comic Graham Chapman. Chapman was a founding member of Monty Python's Flying Circus, the six-man British comedy group which broke up audiences at home and abroad with their performances on TV, films, and records.
Not this record! Not this record! Not this record!
Chapman starred in two Monty Python films. He played King Arthur in Monty Python and the Holy Grail and Brian in the biblical epic The Life of Brian. On their TV shows and records, Chapman played a variety of roles, from the stuffy civil servant to the old biddy to the straight man who would come in to force the sketch to conclude.
Stop that! It's silly. Very silly indeed.
The Pythons created a comic style based on surrealistic wordplay, and Chapman was memorable in some of the troupe's classic sketches.
I'd like to have an argument, please.
Certainly, sir. Have you been here before?
No, I haven't. This is my first time.
I see. Well, do you want to have just one argument, or were you thinking of taking a course?
Well, what is the cost?
Well, it's £1 for a 5-minute argument, but only £8 for a course of 10.
Well, I think it would be best if I perhaps started off with just the one and then see how it goes.
Fine. Well, I'll see who's free at the moment. Mr. DeBakey's free, but he's a little bit conciliatory. Ah, yes. Try Mr. Barnard, room 12.
Thank you.
What do you want?
Well, I was told outside that...
Don't give me that, you snotty-faced heap of parrot droppings!
What?
Shut your festering gob, you tit! Your type really makes me puke, you vacuous, toffee-nosed, malodorous pervert!
Look, I came here for an argument. I'm not going to just...
Oh, I'm sorry, but this is abuse.
Oh, I see. Well, that explains...
Ah, yes. You want room 12A, just along the corridor.
Oh, thank you very much. Sorry.
Not at all.
Thank you.
Stupid git.
That was Chapman dishing out the abuse. In addition to being an inspired comic writer and actor, Chapman is a trained physician, a gay rights activist, and a recovering alcoholic. If you've lost track of him since the Pythons broke up, he's been a stand-up comic, a lecturer, author, and film producer. Welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Let's talk about the kinds of parts that you played in Monty Python. I think it was a pretty wide range.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it was fairly.
Did your physical, you're very tall, first or second tallest in the group? Did
the
your
second
physical traits,
tallest, yes.
John, did that determine?
John is about, he's 6 foot five. I'm just under 6 foot four. So, yes, he's got me by an inch.
Did your height determine what kind of roles you played?
Well, it did in a way, because John and I tended to get the authority roles, I suppose, because it was simpler to play the authority figures as being larger than the people who bore the brunt of their activities. So, yes, that did affect casting quite a bit. Hmm.
You played the civil servant a lot and the colonel role a lot. What kind of accent would you have to do for people in positions like that?
Pretty middle-of-the-road BBC English, really, I suppose.
Which is?
Well, it's more or less as the colonel spoke, you know. So... not too heavy a regional accent, no particular region attached to it. It's sort of like the supposedly the Queen's English, I suppose.
Can you do the difference between a working class civil servant and upper class English accent? You've got them all down?
Well, yes, of various kinds. I mean, there are different accents within those groups as well, really. And England is a very small place, but there are an enormous number of accents within that place.
You've done the old biddy. Type role. Let's listen to an example of that, and
okay.
Then we'll talk about how this voice came to be. And this is Monty Python's Flying Circus.
Hello, Mrs. Premise.
Oh, hello, Mrs. Conclusion.
Busy day?
Busy. I just spent 4 hours burying the cat.
4 hours to bury the cat?
cat?
Yes, I wouldn't keep still, wriggling about, howling.
Oh, it's not dead then?
Oh, no, no, but it's not at all a well cat. And as we're going away for a fortnight, I thought I'd better bury it just to be on the safe side.
Right, right. You don't want to come back from Sorrento to a dead cat, do you?
Yes.
We've decided to have the budgie put down.
Oh, is it very old then?
No, we just don't like it.
Oh, how do they put budgies down?
Well, it's funny you should ask that. I've been reading a great big book on how to put your budgie down. And evidently you can either hit them with the book, or you can shoot them there just above the beak.
Mrs. Essence flushed hers down the loo.
Oh, that's dangerous, because they breed in the sewers, and eventually you get huge, evil-smelling flocks of soiled budgies flying out of people's lavatories, infringing their personal freedom.
Now, Graham Chapman, you're the one with the budgie in that sketch.
That's right, yes, with the budgie with the problem. Yes, well, I suppose they originated those kind of characters. I hesitate to call them women or ladies because they were too grotesque to be called that, in a sense. But I suppose it was from observing women in supermarkets talking, and John and I just imagined them not so much talking about perhaps what they were talking about, which was most likely about the latest washing powder or whatever, but talking about, say, French philosophers or... And to transpose different kind, to have them talking about logic, for instance, was a startling thing, we felt. And anyway, began to quite enjoy those characters because they were so far removed from our own selves, and obviously in dress too. One was taking a bit of a liberty, and that meant that you yourself were freer to say what you wanted. Somehow, it liberated yourself. You were so far removed from being yourself that. You could more easily perhaps say what came into your head straight off, and that's frequently how those characters were written.
How do you get the voice?
Well, with slight difficulty, but not a great deal.
Were your sketches when you started with Monty Python considered too risque or too eccentric? Did you have any trouble with it?
Well, the BBC, to begin with, didn't like us very much, which was actually strangely in our favour, because they put us out at a very unpopular hour of the evening, late on a Sunday night, which is not a top slot in Britain. Also, they frequently preempted us with important things like horse show jumping, and they generally didn't rate us very highly, which was good, because that meant they didn't even bother to read the scripts. So that meant we could... do more or less as we wanted. It wasn't until towards the end of the second series of programmes that they began to realise that we were picking up quite an audience. And then, of course, they began to read the scripts, and that did lead to one or two problems. But we had then a sort of precedent to point to. We could say, but we said that in programme 3 or whatever, and they would listen to it and found out that we had, and that they had no complaints. And so, you know, we could say, we can say it again then.
Several of you, I think, had started writing for a David Frost show before you...
That's
formed your
right.
own program.
That's where five of us really worked for the first time together.
Is that a spoof of the news?
Well, no, it was a topical-ish sketch show. At least they tried to make it sound topical, although in fact really it was just a sketch show in disguise.
Did you think of yourselves as really departing from all your predecessors who did comedy on the BBC?
Well, we wanted to do something new. I think we were... Both John and I are talking about now, particularly influenced earlier in our lives by a radio show called The Goon Show, which was a kind of anarchic radio comedy. And that broke new ground in radio. And also, incidentally, the BBC didn't like that programme very much either. They were similar to us in that respect. And they found it awkward to live with. It frequently poked fun at the BBC too, which... We certainly did as well and had reason to. Censorship-wise, no huge problems, really, as I was saying. I mean, there were one or two examples, but, naughty words, really. Just silly, childish, naughty words that they would find objectionable. I suppose because they probably had a problem with their early toilet training, the BBC.
That must be it.
Yes, I think so. Found sensitive areas.
My guest is comic Graham Chapman. If you're just joining us, he was one of the founding members of Monty Python's Flying Circus. You have been a gay rights activist and, I think, edited a gay paper, gay journal.
I didn't edit it. What I did really was just to provide them with a little bit of cash in the early days so that they could get a newspaper started. There was a kind of collective which formed a newspaper called Gay News, and that ran for about 10 years until it finally sort of broke up, largely because of new ownership and problems with the old editor wanting too much money, I think. But it's kind of spawned a lot of other papers from it.
Were you out when you helped form Monty Python?
Yes. That was some time before that. I mean, it happened at a time also when I decided to veer away from medicine and go into comedy. My life sort of changed at that point, at the age of about 26. I'd finished at medical school, I'd qualified. I went off to a Mediterranean island to write a movie script with John Cleese, and we were going to be there for 3 months. And at that point, I suppose I began to behave in a more natural way for myself than I had previously. I'd been rather hidebound by convention, pretty conventional upbringing. Certainly, medical schools on the whole are pretty conventional, or they certainly were in terms of their attitude towards sexual matters. Not a place to consider coming out, for instance, really. Although I think things are a little better in that direction now. And at that point, I suppose I felt, okay, I'm leaving medicine alone. There was one part of me which felt that I was doing medicine in the first place, perhaps because it would be of some use to other people. A little bit of guilt about that. I thought, well, then perhaps I can do something for people who are gay and who feel isolated. I mean, people used, after all, to commit suicide for that reason, almost that reason alone. To let them know that there were other people like that. It wasn't an unnatural condition. In fact, it's could be considered quite natural if you look at the rest of the animal kingdom in a biological sense. Yes, it's there. It probably serves some function, even, that we don't really know yet. I also actually really don't like labels too much. It sort of pins things down, pigeonholes people rather too much. I would rather not have someone labelled homosexual or heterosexual. I think there's a continuous spectrum which also changes throughout life as well, or should be able to.
The group was comfortable with you coming out publicly? Because I know there was a time in show business, John, where it wasn't much better than in med school.
John Cleese was rather surprised, to say the least. In fact, I think I mentioned it to his girlfriend first. She was happy about it, but John was rather surprised. I think Jonathan Miller summed that up, John surprised, by saying that he thought it was a bit unfair of me. After all, I was a pipe-smoking, rugby-playing mountaineer, not the obvious sort of gay person, I suppose. So it was a surprise for him. I think he understood in the end.
In Monty Python, there's been a lot of jokes about real macho men like the lumberjack, who likes to wear a bra and panties and dress up in women's clothes and hang out at the bar. Maybe you remember the lyrics better than I do to that.
Well, Michael Payne and Terry Jones wrote that, so I don't remember them terribly well. But, yes. But he wished he'd been a girlie just like his dear mama, that one.
But there's a lot of jokes about men cross-dressing and so on. And I never knew whether that was jokes written by gay men or whether I should interpret them as homophobic jokes or just British traditional humor.
No, they're not homophobic. They're very sympathetic, I think. It's we found at that time in Britain, but by using those words openly on our comedy show, that those words in classrooms, and we heard this from teachers, were used openly for the first time without eliciting a sort of snigger or a ridiculous, embarrassed response. And I think that helped to bring things out in the open, to air them a little so that they weren't just hidden away.
I want to play a sketch that I think is really funny, and you initiate this sketch as the colonel, and you're doing the transition here from one sketch to another, and I think this is
about what we're talking about, which is a sketch that takes off on macho men who are really who are really gay. So you want to give this a listen? Do you want to?
Yes, why not?
Okay. And my guest, if you're just joining us, is Graham Chapman, one of the founding members of Monty Python.
Right. Now let's see something decent and military. Some precision drilling. Squad! Camp it! Up!
Who can hurt? Whoops! I've got your number that you couldn't afford me, dear 2-3. I'll scratch your eyes out. Don't come the brigadier bit with us, dear. We all know where you've been, you military fairy. 2-3, 1-2-3-4-5-6-7. Whoops! Don't look now, girls. The major's just minced in with a dolly colour sergeant.
2-3. Ooh!
Right, stop that. Silly. And a bit suspect, I think.
It's even funnier when you get to see it because all the men in military uniforms are flouncing around and doing step kick while they're performing their drill.
Does look extraordinary, doesn't it? Mm.
Who came up with the idea for that sketch?
That was me.
That was you?
Yes, yeah.
And what kind of reaction did you get to it?
Well, I don't think I've ever noticed any particular reaction to it. There again, I think it's sort of airing, giving an airing to a feeling to an idea of gay men too. I mean, they're not all like that. For instance, that's a particular type of extroverted gay that existed most particularly in a day when that was repressed. You know, and they just went to an extreme and so behaved in a what you would call they were called screamers, I suppose you would call them. Yes, in those days. Less of that now, fortunately.
There's never been any that I know of women in the group.
Well, there was Carol Cleveland, who used to play the female roles when we needed a real female.
Was it more fun to have the men play the women than get women in the group?
Not so much the fun. It was cheaper. That was the most important factor. There were just six of us involved with the program, writing it and performing it on the whole. And the BBC, as I said before, didn't like us very much. They didn't give us a very large budget, so we had to try and keep casting down to a minimum. We played, therefore, as many roles as we could ourselves.
A lot of the men in the group dressed in drag for certain roles.
Yes, which is actually not all that unusual in Britain, certainly. I mean, a long tradition of it going right back to Shakespeare and so on, so it didn't seem like anything particularly extraordinary.
Did people interpret that as being gay humor at all, to have men in drag?
It worried people in the States a little bit to begin with. I think there's a certain sensitivity because, of course, the United States male on the whole is very much more bothered about whether he's being butch enough and macho enough, you know. There's less of, I think, people are a bit more relaxed about that sort of thing in Europe, really. They're not so worried about their masculinity because they know it's there, so they don't have to prove it all the time.
My guest is Graham Chapman. He's a founding member of Monty Python's Flying Circus. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in a couple of seconds.
Okay.
This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and is distributed by National Public Radio.
Graham Chapman, I know there was a period, and you've written about this in your autobiography, I know, where you were having problems with alcohol, and then you gave it up.
Mm-hmm.
How much did that affect your career while you were drinking? What period was it?
Well, that was towards the end of the television series, and I actually gave up shortly after filming The Holy Grail, Monty Python and the Holy Grail. In fact, it was the very first day of filming Monty Python and the Holy Grail that I decided that I should stop drinking. And at that point, I'd reached a ridiculous intake per day. I mean, something like 60 fluid ounces of gin, which is monstrous. And prior to that, it was a kind of rock and roll lifestyle that I was leading, I suppose. I drank a lot with my dear friend at the time, Keith Moon, who died shortly after I'd given up drinking. I'd watched him dry out a couple of times, knew that I would have to go through that process as well. But at some point if I ever was going to stop. But on the first day of shooting of Holy Grail, we were out on a Scottish mountainside at 7 o'clock in the morning, and it was wet and cold, and I hadn't come prepared with any alcohol. I hadn't got a hip flask or anything. The nearest village was 20 miles away, and there were no trucks available because the camera broke down, so they were all running around trying to get another part for the camera. And I had my... We started shooting 1.5 hours late. By then I was going through DTs, really, shivering a lot, shaking, feeling pretty nauseous and nasty. And I had the scene to do as King Arthur, where he crosses the Bridge of Death over the Gorge of Eternal Peril. Well, that sort of rang big bells. That suggested to me something. I felt, well, this isn't fair to the others, it's not fair to me. Wait a minute, it's not fair to me, that is stupid. I will stop. But couldn't stop immediately then, because I had the film to make. I couldn't afford the time to or neither could the film, for me to go through the drying out process. So I kept myself topped up to a reasonable level for me then, which would have been appalling for anyone else, I think. But and then 2 months after, roughly, after we'd finished filming, I gave up at Christmas time.
It must have been really hard to go through the withdrawal. I think you went through it cold turkey on your own?
Yes, I did. It's not wise to do it on your own. But I suppose I wanted to do it that way. You know, it's part of, in a way, I needed to do it myself. Now, I think everyone has to make the decision themselves. If a person doesn't feel that they want to stop, then it's very difficult to stop them. You know, you can't really. They have to make that decision themselves. I had made that decision, and that was the only difficult thing, really. That actually, the withdrawal period, okay, that was sort of unpleasant physically a bit, but, I mean, quite bearable. And the rest was pretty easy. One just got better and better. And found that, I was able to do things that I hadn't been able to do well for some time, very easily, like turn up on time for things and learn lines and act.
Yeah, had that been affecting...
became a very simple matter.
Had that been affecting the kind of roles that you were getting?
Well, it may have, but not a lot, I don't think. I was pretty good at covering up, and I don't think the other members of the group realised quite how much I was drinking.
Mm. You're in America, as we speak, touring at various clubs and, I suppose, colleges as well.
Mm.
I know that because of your popularity in America, you must be pretty aware of American humor. I think that there's a lot of British humor and Monty Python-type humor that a lot of Americans don't necessarily get because the language is so different.
Yes, I suppose there are. Although we were quite fortunate in that respect, in that during the whole TV series, we tended not, on the whole, to use topical humour, and also, on the whole, not really to mention or take off characters of the time, political figures and so on. If they were mentioned, then it was just generic. It was just that they were an example of a breed, not necessarily to indicate that particular person. So that has meant that it is relatively timeless, at least, although there obviously are one or two specific things that will be pretty meaningless now. And also, because of the area and where we were filming or where we were performing these sketches, and also because of the location sometimes, and the local dialects, things might be at first pretty meaningless to an American audience, we imagine, certainly. But they seem to pick up on it, and to persist and indeed find translations if they can't understand them first off.
Well, I think one of my favorite sketches is Spam, the Spam song.
Oh, yes, yes.
And, of course, I'd never, as an American, eaten Spam. I think they actually sell it in many of the supermarkets, but I think of it as being a very English.
Well, it isn't. I thought it was always made here.
Is it really?
It's something we got given during the war.
People are nodding to me, I think.
It was shipped over to Britain to feed us during the war, you see.
So we Americans are responsible for this.
Yes, and it's its 50th birthday this very year.
Did you write the Spam song by any chance?
No, that was Mike and Terry. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. You had studied to be a doctor.
Yes.
And gave that up to become a comic.
Mm-hmm.
Ever wish it was the other way around?
No, I mean, medicine is now a very good hobby of mine. But I guess I went towards medicine because of family background and so on. My brother was aiming in that direction too. He's now a surgeon. He's 4 years older than me. And it was easier to go along that path than to take a rather more dramatic and less secure kind of direction in terms of writing and acting. It seemed almost an impossibility from the point of view of my parents, at least. That's what I always wanted to do, though. That was in my subconscious. I didn't allow that to surface until I arrived at Cambridge University, met John Cleese there. We began writing together and doing little bits of cabaret and eventually, even while at college, writing for TV. That carried on after I was at doing my clinical studies at St. Bartholomew's Hospital and, in fact, wrote with John for two whole series of programmes, TV programmes, during that period.
Are you still collaborating with John Cleese now?
Yes. I mean, it's been some 27 years now, on and off. I mean, there have been huge patches where we've been doing other things individually. But, yeah.
So are there more movies in the works?
Well, there's nothing in the works at the moment as a group. No, we're all doing our own individual things. But I think we're all optimistic that there will be another movie at some point, though when, we don't know. Well, last time I spoke to John Cleese, he said, well, maybe when we're about 50, which isn't long now in his case, certainly. So, yes, I think we are optimistic about it. But the difficult thing is getting six people to agree on a subject. It really is quite tricky.
Well, what's your collaborating method when you are working together?
Well, John and I wrote together. Michael Palin and Terry Jones wrote together. Eric wrote on his own. And then Terry Gilliam did all the animations and the visual side of things.
So would you lock yourself up in a room and try to write sketches together?
Yeah, well, John and I would just meet up and sit there for an hour or so, trying to avoid work at all costs, drinking cups of coffee and reading the newspapers, talking about what was in the news, maybe anything to put off that awful moment of having to put something on paper. And then about an hour before lunchtime, we'd begin to feel guilty that we hadn't done anything. And at that point, we would hopefully think of something which had either occurred during that first hour or so, or if not, then in desperation, open up Roger's Thesaurus and simply look at a collection of words to see if that inspired anything, which it sometimes did.
I'll bet it did, because so many of your sketches were wordplay, and it wasn't logical, but it was hysterical.
Look at the cheese shop sketch, for instance.
Oh, and the cheese
almost
dancing.
almost directly from Roger's Thesaurus.
What did you look up that led to that?
Well, we were into cheeses anyway, so we simply looked at that point. We liked the idea of a shop which contained absolutely nothing that it claimed it sold, which is just a minor exaggeration of the way some British shops are. So that was what we were getting at, I think, and decided on cheese as being the comestible in point, and so just looked up a whole list of cheeses in Roger, added a few, and there it was. It took about 2 minutes to write, I think, in the end.
When you're a comic writer and you're writing with a collaborator, do you laugh at each other's funny lines?
Yes, and also laugh together, too. I mean, there's one whole sketch when John and I, we perhaps had gone a bit too far, but we felt guilty about it while we were writing it, which made us laugh hysterically. And that was the Undertaker's sketch. I mean, perhaps we had gone too far. You know, people taking their dead mothers into Undertakers in a sack, you know, it's on sort of tricky ground, isn't it?
And then they had to decide if they were going to burn them,
bury them,
or dump them.
Right.
Yeah.
Yes. That made us feel guilty, I suppose, because all the time we were thinking of our own dear mothers, and it is a bit far to go, isn't it?
Well, this is a real serious issue, I think. If you're writing humor like that, do you want your mother to hear it?
No, you don't. Fortunately, with John and I, we did frequently, I suppose, really think of our own mothers when we were writing sketches. John always used the excuse that it was my mother, and I always used the excuse that it was his. And they seem to believe that quite satisfactorily.
Your mothers believe that?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I'm really sorry that we're out of time. I've really enjoyed meeting you, and I thank you.
Thank you.
Very much for talking with us. My guest has been Graham Chapman, who's a founding member of Monty Python's Flying Circus, and he's now an author and film producer as well as a comic and actor. This is Fresh Air. Fresh Air is funded in part with a major grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional funding comes from listeners to WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. This is NPR, National Public Radio. From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up on Fresh Air, photographer Bruce Davidson talks about his year-long adventure on the New York City subways. The pictures of his fellow riders are gathered in his latest book of photographs. Music critic Francis Davis reviews a new record that revives an adventurous 1924 concert that premiered Rhapsody in Blue. And TV critic David Bianculli gives his surefire ways to avoid the worst on television. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, this news. This is Fresh Air. George Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue is one of the most frequently performed works by an American composer. Now there's a recording of a new version, which turns out to be an old version. Jazz critic Francis Davis has this review.
George Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue occupies a curious place in the modern orchestral repertoire. Essentially a piano concerto, it's a bounding showpiece for soloist and orchestra, a real crowd pleaser. But conductors treat it as a diversion, a relief from weightier standard concert fare. It's almost as though it's on the program as an affirmative action on behalf of 20th century American composers. Meanwhile, Rhapsody in Blue's misrepresentation as fodder for the likes of Arthur Fiedler alienates the jazz and pop audiences to whom this masterpiece rightly belongs. Rhapsody in Blue was commissioned by the dance band leader Paul Whiteman and given its premiere by Whiteman's orchestra at New York's Aeolian Hall on Lincoln's birthday in 1924 with Gershwin himself on piano. This concert marked the first intrusion of a classical music sanctuary by an American dance band. Its stated purpose was to make an honest woman out of jazz, a well-meaning sentiment that's done nothing to endear Whiteman or Gershwin to those of us who hear nothing particularly whorish about jazz unwed to the symphony. 3 years ago, in celebration of the 60th anniversary of the concert, conductor Maurice Perez mounted a recreation of nearly all the music performed at Aeolian Hall that night, including Rhapsody in Blue and works by Victor Herbert, Cees Confrey, Freddie Grofe, and Rudolph Frimmel. Now there is a digital studio recording of Perez's recreation. It's titled The Birth of Rhapsody in Blue. It's a 2-LP set on the Music Masters label. To say that Perez and piano soloist Ivan Davis's interpretation of Rhapsody in Blue is different from any other on record isn't critical hyperbole, merely a statement of fact. For starters, Perez has reinserted piano and orchestral passages which were excised for reasons of space from the presumably definitive recording that Gershwin made with Whiteman shortly after the premiere. But more important, Perez has reclaimed the work for jazz by restoring saxophones and banjo to the position of dominance they enjoyed in the original dance band orchestration. The difference in harmonic shimmer and rhythmic punch is astonishing, most noticeably on that celebrated slow finale.
Thank you.
If this record gives an accurate representation, Rhapsody in Blue outclassed everything else performed at Aeolian Hall that night. But the other stuff was pretty delightful, however minor. Surprisingly, the pieces one would have thought would date most badly are among the set's freshest sounding. For example, the tearjerker to An Irish Rose, or better still, this, Rudolf Rimmel's Chansonnette. An excerpt from Rudolf Rimmel's Chansonnette, or Donkey Serenade, as it was unfortunately retitled after being saddled with lyrics. I suppose it's easy to dismiss music this prim as period kitsch, but only after acknowledging what a fertile period this was and what noble kitsch it produced. Although most of the music on The Birth of Rhapsody in Blue registers as quaint today, one can make a case for it as postmodern in its willingness to toss everything into the Cuisinart. Today's postmodernists should be as savvy as the class of 1924 and knowing where to shop for fresh ingredients. Paul Whiteman's Aeolian Hall concert was a landmark in American music. So is Maurice Perez's loving recreation.
Francis Davis is the author of In the Moment, Jazz in the 1980s. He also writes for The Atlantic and the Philadelphia Inquirer and is jazz critic for Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and is distributed by National Public Radio.
Every day, more than 2 million New Yorkers ride the subways. For many, it's the fastest, cheapest, yet most menacing way to get from one part of the city to another. One of these regular riders is photographer Bruce Davidson. In 1980, he spent the year photographing the daily life of the city's underground transit system. What emerged is a collection of photographs called Subway. For Davidson, the subway became more than a means of transportation.
It became kind of a metaphor for me for the world. A kind of a compression of all the atoms of peoples, as if human beings were suddenly became atoms and they were compressed in space and about to explode. I found that the subway, with its graffiti, with its violence, with its metallic fluorescent glow, with its underground reality, that it had something to say about today, about the way we live, way we live in kind of a crumbling, terrorized world.
What was your routine like when you were traveling the subways to photograph them?
Typically, what I did over the year that I photographed in the subway was to ride the subway 8-10 hours a day without a destination. I would explore all the lines to the end of the line, sometimes riding the subway at 2 in the morning from one end to the other.
A lot of muggers work the subways, and with your camera equipment, you'd really make a great target. Did you do anything to make yourself seem less vulnerable?
Well, the way I worked in the subway was, and the way I always work, or at least I try to work, is with the camera open, exposed. Of course, I'm targeted for muggers or robbers or other people in the subway, but I felt that if I made contact, eye-to-eye contact with people, and I might have a chance of mugging them before they mugged me.
Mugging them? You mean like
mugging them with
them?
My camera in a kind of a mugshot. Later, I found out that the undercover detectives in the police, and there are quite a number of them, got word back to headquarters that this kind of new kind of hustler was on the subway that they've never seen before. And they've seen guys with bongo drums and guys with doing all kinds of, hustles on the subway. But they had never seen anyone making photographs before. And that sort of came back to headquarters, and they couldn't make any sense out of it.
So you became one of the characters who ride the subways all the time.
Yes, another queer.
There are some real characters on the subways. The last time I was on the New York subways, someone came in who really smelled of urine, and he said, "I am a homeless person. I do not have a home like you do." This was an announcement he was making to everyone in the car. He said, "I don't have a home like you do. I am living off of the generosity of a friend who is poor. If you do not help me now and give me some money, I will be forced to turn to a life of crime." And of course, you get the message there that if you don't offer this guy a dollar or whatever, by tomorrow he'll be a mugger. Have you met him? I have a feeling he works the subways a lot.
I've seen a lot of men smelling of urine, and most of them like to sit down between beautifully dressed women and watch their expressions. Everything goes in the subway, but there's another part of the subway that I'm interested in. There's a certain beauty in the subway, a certain theater. Sometimes you're in a subway car and you feel very close to everybody in the subway. I think a great love affair could be made in a subway.
A lot of people on the New York subways just stare at each other, and the way that the seats are arranged, they're long seats, bench-like seats, that just line the length of the subway. So you sit facing the people opposite you, and the hobby of people who ride the subways is just to stare at the other people. Now, the trick is to not let on that you're staring, because a lot of people are very insulted if they find out that you're staring at them. What you're doing is not only staring, but you're staring through a camera and taking their photograph. Did a lot of people get angry with you, hostile with you, because you wanted to photograph them?
No. During the year I was on the subway, I had very few situations where people were hostile towards me. First of all, I carried the camera open. Second of all, about a third of the time I approached someone with this camera open, and I asked them if I could make a photograph. I enjoyed the mood that they were in. Would they go back into it? They either would say yes or no. If they hesitated, I brought out my album. I had a small wedding album full of my subway pictures, and I showed it to them. If they said no, then it was no forever. If they said yes, then I would go back and photograph them.
For me, the most distressing photo in your album is a photograph of a homeless, gray-haired woman. Her hair is really matted. She's standing alone in a subway car, picking up her soiled house dress and exposing herself, and she's naked underneath the dress. And off to her side is a mess of squished-up food that seems mixed in with old clothes, maybe even underwear, and what looks to be a couple of shoes. What's the story behind that photo?
This woman came into the train at about 3 o'clock in the morning. It was an empty train. I was on my way home. I had been photographing actually some naked men who were living in the subway, and this woman in this empty car began to undress and out of a bag made this vomitous mess in the middle of the floor of crushed strawberries and cornflakes and soiled clothing and whatnot. And I asked her if I could make a photograph of her. And she didn't say no, and I lifted my camera and made a flash. And then I made another flash, and she lifted her dress. Just as she lifted her dress and exposed her somewhat naked body, three youths charged into the train from another car, seeing my flash, and they looked at me with my expensive camera and flash, and they looked at her, and then they looked at this mess on the floor, and one of them said, "Hey, man, let's get out of here." She threw up all over the train. So I learned something from the situation, that this mess that she was making on the floor was a bonfire to ward off the wild animals, the beasts, because that time of night, young people in the subway are looking to rob other people very often, and wolf packs.
That's pretty ironic in a way that three teenagers who might have been muggers after your expensive equipment would be scared away from a mess to them that looked like vomit.
It would be, but I think that the sight of her lifting her dress, the sight of the vomit, and my camera going off, flash going off, was too much for them, and they ran away.
Too crazy even for them.
Even too crazy for them.
In your book, you wrote that your wife said that you weren't going to stop photographing in the subways until you were mugged. Well, you were mugged after a while. What happened?
Well, what happened was my family was away. It was a hot July day. I was riding the subway. It was 2 o'clock in the afternoon. I was deep in Brooklyn. I was bored. I wanted to be with my family, and I turned my back on a couple of youths that I had approached and sort of forgot my presence, and they took advantage of it, and the two of them jumped me. I broke all the rules. I was in the end car. I wasn't aware. I was a sitting duck. I think I probably wanted to get mugged. I felt it was maybe my dues, you know. But I had one camera left. They only managed to get one in the struggle. And I continued that day photographing slowly. I was afraid of everybody, you know. But slowly I began to photograph. And I went on for a couple months after that working.
You're officially completed with your subway series now. Do you take taxis now, or do you still ride the subways?
No, I still ride the subways. It's not a state of mind. I'm not possessed by the subway any longer. It was an obsession. I could hear it rumbling below my windows at night, and I would get out of bed sometimes and get dressed and enter the subway like some sort of werewolf. It had a calling. Just the sound of the steel wheels on the tracks would call me in.
Are you glad to be through with that?
I'm glad to be through with the tension in the subway. I'm onto other things. I may work on landscapes. I'm thinking about doing a number of things. But my work doesn't come from just a good idea. It comes from some state of mind, some need within myself that compels me to come close to subject matter, because I spend a long time with whatever I do. So it has to have some real meaning for me to sustain that effort.
Bruce, thank you very much for talking with us.
Okay, thank you very much, Terry.
Bruce Davidson, his new book of photographs is called Subway. This is Fresh Air. Stay tuned for full coverage of today's news on All Things Considered. Let's check in with Robert Siegel, who co-hosts All Things Considered. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry.
What stories are you following today?
Well, we're following an announcement in Washington that the Justice Department has placed Kurt Waldheim on a watch list because of evidence that he participated in Nazi war crimes. That watch list would bar him from entering the United States, even though he is, that is, the former U.N. Secretary General, is now the Austrian president. Also, an urging from President Reagan to Congress to avoid retaliation against the United States' trading partners. He said that that's dangerous and it risks sending our economic relationships with those countries into the sea. And a report on AZT, the only known effective treatment for AIDS. And Patricia Naimond will tell us why that drug is being rationed right now.
Okay, thank you, Robert. All Things Considered is coming up later today from National Public Radio. Savvy television viewers today want to ferret out the programs that are really awful from those that are only marginally bad. Television critic David Bianculli has a foolproof formula.
Anyone who saw Green Acres knows it wasn't one of TV's finest hours, or half hours, but there was a way to know that without ever seeing an episode, thanks to the 10 early warning signs of bad TV. One of the few advantages a TV show has over a book is that you can judge a TV show by its cover, or at least by its title. By watching out for a few key words or phrases, you can save yourself from exposure to those shows that would, after you've seen them, make you want to scream or shower. These warning signs are like mathematical theorems and are occasionally changed when contrary evidence presents itself. Green Acres, for example, would at one time have been identified by the rule that said beware of shows with colors in their title. That rule worked just fine in the days of Red Fox, Green Hornet, and Pink Lady, but it was made obsolete by The White Shadow, 10 Speed and Brown Shoe, and Hill Street Blues. But just as surely as there are new shows to replace the old, there are new rules to replace the old. Here's a current list of the 10 early warning signs of bad TV. Enjoy them and employ them. Rule 1. Avoid all shows that abuse spelling or grammar. This rule protects viewers from Gimme a Break and the recently revived Me and Mrs. C. In the past, it nailed down such putrid programs as Different Strokes, which was spelled without an E, and We Got It Made, which was made without a brain. Rule 2. Shows that call themselves amazing aren't. Amazing stories should have been titled Marginally Interesting Stories. And who remembers The Amazing Dunninger, The Amazing Polgar, The Amazing Spider-Man? Amazing. Rule 3. Shows with new in the title are not improved. That means skip the new Mike Hammer and the new Gidget and any other show that follows in the tradition of the new Adventures of Perry Mason or the new Christy Minstrels. It's okay to apply this rule to all game shows, including the Newlywed Game, but don't get carried away and avoid Newhart. Rule 4. If a show changes its title, change the channel. Here's another reason to skip the new Mike Hammer, which used to be called, I don't know, the old Mike Hammer. It also applies to Nothing Is Easy, which used to be Together We Stand. If the product's good, the label won't change. Rule 5. See if you can guess the next rule by listening to this audio daily double. Right, those themes were all from shows with numbers in their title. Hawaii 5-0, Route 66, 77 Sunset Strip. Rule number 5 is, numbers don't add up to much. The exception is 60 Minutes, but otherwise the rule warns against such shows as 2020, West 57th, 227, and Take 5. It also predicted the demise of 1986, the show, not the year. Rule 6, spin away from spin-offs. The Tortellis was such an inferior spin-off of Cheers that it should have been called Booze, spelled with an S, not a Z-E. And the same rule will apply probably next year to the Lisa Bonet spinoff of The Cosby Show. Rule 7. Beware of exclamation points. This means shows like Gimme a Break and Sledgehammer. And That's Incredible, if you remember that. Excitement in the title means no excitement in the show. Stay away from these. This means you. Rule 8. Never watch anything with an Osmond in it. This rule is self-explanatory and has no exceptions. Rule 9. Question all question marks. For several seasons now, the correct answer to any question posed in a show's title has been total apathy. What really happened to the class of 65? Who cares? Who done it? Who cares? Who's the boss? Who cares? You again? Not me. Rule 10. If a show changes addresses, don't follow. There are a few welcome exceptions to this rule, but in most cases, a move to another network means a drop in quality. This is true of Alfred Hitchcock Presents, which was canceled by NBC, but is alive barely on the USA network. Most TV shows were bad enough when they're fresh. Who needs leftovers?
David Bianculli is television critic for the New York Post and for Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. And that's our show for today. On the next Fresh Air, my guest will be conductor Helmut Rilling, who's acclaimed for his interpretation of the Baroque repertoire. I'll also speak with novelist Diane Johnson about her new book, Persian Nights. Our rock and roll historian Ed Ward will make his case for hearing Bo Diddley as a folk poet. And book critic John Leonard will review a new novel by South African writer Nadine Gordimer. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by a major grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting Radio Fund. Additional support comes from NPR member stations and the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia.
Fresh Air is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Production assistant, Ed Doherty. The engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. Our theme music is composed and performed by Jackie Byard. My name is Terry Gross. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned. This is NPR, National Public Radio.